They were tall and pointed, like teepees, weatherproofed, and planned for 9 men. We were rarely fewer than 20, and even at that there weren't enough tents. Luckily, we had raided our stores of food because of the cold, and with enough to eat, we were able to keep going reasonably well. Some of us began to crawl with vermin, as we were only rarely able to wash, and when we returned to Minsk, our first duty was to pass through disinfection. I was beginning to feel that I'd had more than enough of Holy Russia and of truck driving. Like everybody else, I was afraid of the idea of being under fire, but I was also beginning to long to use the Morza which had been dragging around with me for what seemed like an eternity, without ever being the slightest use. I felt that somehow firing at something would avenge me for my sufferings from the cold, and from my blisters. My hands were badly blistered from shoveling, and my woolen gloves were already full of holes, exposing the tops of my icy fingers. My hands and feet felt the cold so sharply that it sometimes seemed as if the pain were stabbing me in the heart. The thermometer remained around 5 degrees below zero. We were now billeted some 15 miles north of Minsk, guarding a huge parking depot for military vehicles. We occupied the 7 or 8 houses in the hamlet, leaving only one, the largest, occupied by a Russian family. Their name was Korsky. They had 2 daughters and claimed to have originally come from the Crimea, which they spoke of with nostalgia. They ran a kind of canteen where we could buy food and drink from our own pockets and find a few companions with whom to kill time. The snow had stopped, but the cold was growing steadily more intense. One evening after our company had been in the hamlet for about a week, I was scheduled for 2 hours of guard duty. I crossed the huge parking lot, where 500 or more vehicles of every description were half buried in snow. I had been feeling apprehensive all day at the prospect of walking across this space at night. It would be so easy for partisans to hide between the cars and shoot us as we went by. But I had gradually persuaded myself that the war, if it existed at all, was really taking place somewhere else. The only Russians I had seen were either merchants or prisoners, and it seemed highly probable that I would never see any others. With this idea in my head, I walked to my post, about 15 yards from the first vehicles, through a trench about a yard deep, which allowed us to advance as far as the cars, or withdraw, without being exposed. The edges of the trench had already been raised nearly another 3 feet by new snow, and each fresh fall obliged us to dig. I stood up on the box that allowed the sentry to see a little farther. I had wrapped a blanket over my coat, which made it very hard for me to move my arms. I had refused my allotment of alcohol, the taste of which disgusted me, and was mentally preparing myself for another siege of uncontrollable trembling from the cold. The night was clear. I could have seen a raven 100 yards off. In the distance, the horizon was cut by a mass of stunted bushes. 3 of the 4 telephone lines which crossed our camp were visible, stretching away in different directions. Their posts, shoved unevenly into the ground, were in different supports for the wire, which sometimes drooped right down to the snow. My nose, the only part of me directly exposed, began to burn with cold. I had pulled my cap down as far as I could, so that my forehead and part of my cheeks were covered. Over this I wore the helmet required for guard duty. The turned-up collar of the pullover my parents had sent me overlapped the edge of my cap at the back of my head. From time to time I looked at the expanse of machinery I was guarding and wondered what we would do if we had to move it all in a hurry. The engines must have reached a state of magnificent solidity. I had been at my post for a good hour when suddenly a silhouette appeared at the edge of the parking lot. I threw myself down into the bottom of my hole. Before extracting my hands from the depths of my pockets, I risked another look over my parapet. The silhouette was advancing toward me. It must be one of our men making the rounds, but supposing it was a Bolshevik. Grunting with the effort, I pulled my hands from their shelter and grabbed my gun. The breech, sticky with frost, bit into my fingers, as I maneuvered my weapon into firing position and shouted out, "Where D.A.?" I got back a reasonable reply, and my bullet remained in the gun. All the same, I had been prudent to take these elementary precautions. It was an officer going his rounds. I saluted. Everything all right?
Yes, Lieutenant.
Fine.
Well, happy Christmas.
What? Is it Christmas?
Yes. Look over there. He pointed to the Korsky's house. The roof, loaded with snow, sloped down to ground level. The narrow windows were shining far more brightly than blackout regulations usually permitted, and in their light I could see the swiftly moving silhouettes of my comrades. A few moments later a tall flame burst from an enormous woodpile which must have been soaked with gasoline. A song supported by 300 voices ascended slowly into the stillness of the frozen night. O Weihnacht! O Stillnacht! Was it possible? At that moment, everything beyond the perimeter of the camp was without meaning for me. I couldn't tear my eyes from the light of the bonfire. The faces closest to the flames were illuminated, the rest were lost in darkness, while the strong outpouring of song continued, divided now into several parts. Perhaps the circumstances of this particular Christmas night made a critical difference, but in all the time since then I haven't heard anything which moved me so much. The memories of my earliest youth, still so close, returned to me for the first time since I had been a soldier. What was happening at home this evening? What was happening in France? We had heard bulletins which informed us that many French troops were now fighting along with us, news which made me rejoice. The thought of Frenchmen and Germans marching side by side seemed marvelous to me. Soon we would no longer have to be cold, the war would be over, and we could all recite our adventures at home. This Christmas hadn't brought me any gift I could hold in my hand, but had brought so much good news about the harmony between my two countries that I felt overwhelmed. Because I knew that I was now a man, I kept firmly at the back of my mind a foolish and embarrassing idea which kept pursuing me. I really would have liked someone to give me an ingenious mechanical toy. My companions were still singing, and all along the front millions like them must have been singing as they were. I didn't know that, at that very hour, Soviet T-34 tanks, taking advantage of the truce which Christmas was supposed to bring, were crushing the forward posts of the 6th Army in the Armatovsk sector. I didn't know that my comrades in the 6th Army, in which one of my uncles was serving, were dying by the thousands in the hell of Stalingrad. I didn't know that German towns were being subjected to the horrifying bombardments of the RAF and the USAF, and I would never have dared to think that the French would refuse a Franco-German entente. This was, in its way, the most beautiful Christmas I had ever seen, made entirely of disinterested emotion and stripped of all tawdry trimmings. I was all alone beneath an enormous starred sky, and I can remember a tear running down my frozen cheek, a tear neither of pain nor of joy but of emotion created by intense experience. By the time I got back to the billet, the officers had put an end to the celebrations, and ordered the bonfire extinguished. Hals had saved a half bottle of schnapps for me. I swallowed down a few mouthfuls, not to disappoint him. 4 more days went by. The hard cold continued, embellished by snow-filled squalls. We went out only for obligatory duties, which we reduced to the minimum, and burned tons of wood. The houses had been built to conserve heat, and we were sometimes even too hot. We felt very well, and as is usual under such circumstances, we very soon had some trouble. Ours began one morning sometime around 3 o'clock. A guard noisily kicked open the door of the hut, admitting a blast of icy air and 2 soldiers whose stiff, bluish faces made them look remarkably alike. They rushed to our stove, and it was a few minutes before they spoke. Along with everybody else, I shouted at them to shut the door. In reply, we received a curse, and were ordered to stand at attention. As we gaped, somewhat startled and without reaction, the fellow who had shouted kicked over the bench standing next to him, and shouting out his order a second time, hurled himself at the improvised bed of one of our men, violently ripping apart the mound of blankets, coats, and jackets in which our comrade had buried himself. In the dim light of the stove we recognized the epaulettes of a Feldwebel. "Are you bastards going to get the hell up?" he shouted, pulling out everybody he could reach. Who's at the head of this bunch? It's a disgrace. Do you think this is how we'll stop the Russian offensive? If you're not ready in 10 minutes, I'll throw you out of here just the way you are. Stupid with sleep and stunned by our sudden awakening, we hurriedly collected our things. Leaving the door wide open, the Feldwebel rushed from our butt like a madman, to inject panic into the Izba across the way. We had no very clear idea of what was happening. Our sentry, who seemed quite shaken, told us that the intruders had arrived from Minsk in a sidecar. Those 15-odd miles must have taken them quite a long time, which would explain their furious condition. But, despite all the demonic howling the Feldwebel could muster, it was a full 20 minutes before we were standing at attention in the snow. Laus, who had been as deeply asleep as anyone else, tried to shock us into wakefulness with a pretense of rage as intense as his colleagues. The other Feldwebel, whose anger had not abated, barked out our orders: "You will join Commandant Altrena's unit at Minsk before dawn." He turned to Laus. "You will take 15 trucks from the depot and proceed as I've ordered." Why hadn't he telephoned, instead of working himself into such a state? We found out later that, while we had been sleeping peacefully, the telephone line had been cut in 4 places. The difficulty of getting underway and bringing the trucks out from the depot was almost unimaginable. We had to roll out barrels of gasoline and alcohol to fill the gas tanks and radiators, crank up the engines and exhausting labor and shovel out cubic yards of snow, almost entirely without light. When the 15 trucks were ready, we set out for Minsk, following the bumpy, snow-covered track the Feldwebel had taken to reach us. One of the trucks skidded on the icy ground, and it took a good half hour to pull it from the ditch. We hooked it to another truck, which could only skate along the ice. In the end, almost the entire company was involved in the struggle, and we literally carried the damn machine back onto the road. Toward 8 o'clock in the morning, well before the late winter dawn of those regions, we joined Altrena and his regiment, and stood shivering, despite our exertions, in a vast city square, with 2,000 or 3,000 other soldiers. Minsk seemed to be bursting with excitement and energy. A network of loudspeakers which had been set up throughout the square disseminated a short lecture from the high command. The lecture pointed out that even a victorious army had to accept deaths and casualties, and that our role as a convoy unit was to carry, at whatever the cost and despite all the hardships, which the high command thoroughly recognized, the food, munitions, and materiel the combat troops required. Our convoy, by any means available, had to reach the banks of the Volga, so that von Paulus could continue to wage his victorious battle. 1,000 miles separated us from our destination, and we hadn't a moment to spare. We left after the midday meal. I found myself, separated from my closest friends, aboard a 5.5-ton DKW loaded with heavy automatic weapons. The road leaving the city was well ploughed, and we rolled along at a brisk pace. There must have been road gangs working around the clock. The snow banks on either side of the road were nearly 12 feet high. We passed a signpost bristling with pointers. On the sign indicating the road we took I read Nak Pripet, Kiev, Dnieper, Kharkov, Dnipropetrovsk. Our troops had rounded up everyone capable of holding a shovel, and we were able to cover nearly 100 miles in good time. We soon reached the summit of a hill from which we could see the immensity of the Ukraine stretching into the distance under a yellowish-gray sky. The 10 or 12 vehicles ahead of us had suffered a serious reduction in speed. Ahead of them, a company of soldiers were busily engaged in moving snow. A heavy truck was pushing a sled fitted with a kind of ventilator which blew out the snow in all directions. Beyond lay an infinity of immaculate snow nearly 3 feet deep. Heavy snowfalls buried the road so completely after the passage of each convoy that we needed a compass to dig it out again. Our commanding officer and his non-coms had walked a short distance out onto the upswept snow, sinking in over the tops of their boots, and were scanning the horizon, wondering how they could possibly proceed through all that soggy cotton. Inside our DKW, With all the windows shut, I and my traveling companion were relishing the warmth of our running engine. But soon they were ordering us out of our machines and distributing snow shovels. As there weren't enough to go round, our non-coms told us to use anything we could lay our hands on. I saw men digging with boards, helmets, big serving platters. With two other fellows I was pushing against the tailgate of a truck which we had detached, hoping to use it as a crude sort of snowplow. The blast of a Feldwebel's whistle interrupted our disorganized labor. What do you think you're proving over there? Come along with me, we'll go and round up some manpower, bring your guns. I felt a surge of jubilation, which I kept well hidden, as I inwardly thanked the idiots who had devised a hopeless procedure. I preferred almost anything to shoveling snow. We followed the Feldwebel. I had no idea where he hoped to find more manpower. We had only passed two deserted villages since leaving Minsk. With our guns slung, our little group split off from the track the trucks had traced in the snow, and headed north. We sank in over our knees with every step, which made progress extremely difficult. For 10 minutes I did my best to follow the Feldwebel, who was about 15 feet ahead of me. I was gasping for breath, and I could feel the sweat beginning to trickle down my spine under the heavy cloth of my coat. My breath projected long streams of vapor, which vanished instantly in the icy air. I kept my eyes glued to the Feldwebel's deep footprints, trying to step exactly into them, but as he was bigger than I, this meant that every step was a leap. I deliberately avoided looking at the horizon, which seemed so far away. A thin screen of birches soon hid the convoy from us. Ludicrous in our smallness, we continued forward into the immensity of white. I was beginning to wonder where our non-com thought he would find his famous manpower. We had been exhausting ourselves in this way for nearly an hour. Suddenly, in the absolute quiet, we heard a rumbling sound which was growing steadily louder. We stopped. Our sergeant limited himself to the observation that we hadn't much further to go, and then added that it was a pity we would miss this one. I didn't really understand what he was talking about, but the noise was becoming increasingly clear. To our left I caught sight of a black line stretching across the snow. A train. We were approaching a railway line. I still didn't see what a train could do for us. Would they take our cargoes on board? The train was going by very slowly about 500 yards ahead of us. It was extremely long, a line of black broken at intervals by one of the five locomotives, spewing out impressive clouds of white vapor which vanished almost instantly, as if by magic. The train must have had a special mechanism for snow disposal. 15 minutes later, we reached the tracks. A lot of supplely trains go through here, the Feldwebel said. Most of the cars carry materiel, but there are usually a few passenger cars for Russian civilians. We'll stop one of them and collect some Russian labor. Finally I understood. All we had to do now was wait. We tramped briskly up and down the tracks trying to keep warm. However, it felt as if the temperature had risen somewhat, as if by now it might be up to 15 degrees, which indicates the astonishing degree to which we had grown accustomed to zero temperatures. The cold, as we waited for the next train, seemed quite bearable. Soldiers wearing only pullovers were shoveling snow and streaming with sweat. I have never met anyone better able to stand punishment, whether from cold or heat or anything else, than the Germans. Each Russian I saw was more frozen than the last, but I certainly could not feel superior on that account. Life in Russia for me was a perpetual shivering fit. The first train passed by without even slowing down. Our Feldwebel, who had outdone himself in his efforts to stop it, was furious. Soldiers shouted to us from the train that their orders were not to stop for any reason whatever. Extremely irritated, we walked on in the direction of the train which had passed us. At all events, the road must be parallel to the tracks. We would only have to make a right-angle turn to find our compagnie again. The difficulty was that we were far from the kitchen and the hour for the distribution of food must have come and gone. I had 2 pieces of rye bread in my coat pocket, but I didn't want to take them out for fear of having to share them. The two soldiers with whom I had been shoveling snow must have known each other for some time. They were deep in conversation, and had stuck together ever since we'd left the convoy. Our non-com was walking ahead of us, by himself, and I tried to catch up with him. By now we had been walking for some time. The tracks were sunk between two banks which supported a thin growth of scrubby brush. They extended straight ahead into an indefinite distance. If a train came along, we would be able to see it for at least 5 miles. The scrub on the banks at this point was growing more thickly, and extending a greater distance from the tracks. It was now some 3 hours since we had left our company. Everything stood out clearly against the snow. For some moments now I had been staring at a black shape about 500 yards away. 10 minutes later, we could see that it was a hut. Our Feldwyl was walking toward it. It must be a shelter for railway workers. The Feldwyl raised his voice, "Hurry up. We'll wait in that shelter over there." It didn't seem a bad idea. We had regrouped, and a young fellow covered with freckles, one of my snow shoveling companions, was joking with his friend. We were making our way toward the but when a violent burst of sound struck my ears. At the same moment, I saw, to the right of the hut, a light puff of white smoke. Utterly astounded, I looked around at my companions. The Feldwyl had flung himself down on the ground like a goalie onto a ball, and was loading his automatic. The fellow with the freckles was staggering toward me with enormous eyes and a curious stupefied expression. When he was about 6 feet from me, he fell to his knees. His mouth opened as if he wanted to shout, but no sound came, and he toppled over backward. A second barrage of sound ripped the air, followed by a modulated whistle. Without thinking, I threw myself flat on the snow. The Feldwyl's automatic crackled, and I saw some snow from the roof of the butt shoot up into the air. I couldn't take my eyes off the freckled young soldier, whose motionless body lay a few yards away. "Cover me, you idiots," the Feldwyl shouted, as he jumped up and ran forward. I looked at the freckled soldier's friend. He seemed more surprised than frightened. Calmly, we aimed our weapons toward the woods, from which a few shots still rang out, and began to fire. The detonation of my Morse restored some of my confidence, but I was still very scared. Two more bullets whistled in my ears. Our sergeant, with appalling self-assurance, stood up and threw a grenade. The air rang with the noise of the explosion, and one of the worm-eaten planks of the butt disintegrated. With incomprehensible calm, I continued to stare at the cabin. The Feldwyl's automatic was still firing. Without panic, I slid another bullet into the barrel of my gun. As I was about to shoot, two black figures ran from the ruins of the hut, and headed toward the forest. It was a perfect opportunity. My gun sight stood out clearly in black against the white of the countryside, and then merged into the darkness of one of the galloping figures. I pressed the trigger. And missed. Our chief had run as far as the hut, firing after the fleeing men without hitting them. After a moment, he signaled us to join him, and we extricated ourselves from our holes in the snow. The Feldwyl was staring at something in the ruins of the cabin. As we drew closer we could see a man leaning against the wall. His face, half covered by a wild, shaggy beard, was turned toward us. His eyes looked damp. He gazed at us without a word. His clothes, of skin and fur, were not a military uniform. My eye was caught by his left hand. It was soaked with blood. More blood was running from his collar. I felt a twinge of unease for him. The Feldwyl's voice brought me back to reality. "Partisan," he shouted. "Hein? Dot. You know what you're going to get." He pointed his gun at the Russian, who seemed frightened and rolled farther back into the corner. I too recoiled, but our non-com was already putting his automatic back in its holster. "You take care of him," he ordered, waving toward the wounded man. We carried the partisan outside. He groaned, and said something unintelligible. The sound of an approaching train was growing steadily louder. This one, however, was returning to the rear. We managed to stop it. Three soldiers wrapped in heavy reindeer skin coats jumped from the first carriage. One of them was a lieutenant, and we snapped to attention. "What in God's name do you think you're doing?" he barked. "Why did you stop us?" Our non-com explained that we were looking for labor. "This train is carrying only the wounded and dying," the lieutenant said. "If we had some troops on leave, I'd help you out. As it is, I can't do anything for you." "We've got two wounded men," the sergeant ventured. The lieutenant was already walking over to the freckled soldier, who was lying motionless where he had fallen. "You can see that this one's dead."
"No, mein Lieutenant. He's still breathing."
"Ah. Well, maybe. But another 15 minutes. He gestured vaguely. "Well, all right. We'll take him." He whistled at two skeletal stretcher bearers, who lifted our young comrade. I thought I could see a brown stain in the middle of his back, but I wasn't sure whether it was blood mixed with the green of his coat, or something else.
"And the other one?"
the lieutenant asked impatiently. "Over there, beside the hut." The lieutenant looked at the bearded man, who was clearly dying.
"Who's this?"
"A Russian, mein Lieutenant, a partisan. So that's it. Do you really think I'm going to saddle myself with one of those bastards who'll shoot you in the back any time as if war at the front wasn't enough?" He shouted an order to the two soldiers who were with him. They walked over to the unfortunate man lying on the snow, and two shots rang out. A short time later, we were making our way back to the road. Our non-com had abandoned the idea of an improvised labor force, and we would now rejoin our unit, which undoubtedly had not made much progress. I had just been under fire for the first time, an experience I can no longer describe with any precision. An element of the absurd was mixed into the day's events. The Feldwebel's footsteps in the snow were so enormous, and I, in my confusion, kept looking for the young freckled soldier who should have been returning with us. Everything had happened so quickly that I hadn't been able to grasp the significance of anything. Nevertheless, two human beings had suffered senseless deaths. Ours had not yet celebrated his 18th birthday. It had already been dark for some time when we finally found our company. The night was clear and cold, and the thermometer was dropping with horrifying speed. Despite our forced march of nearly 4 hours, we were shaking with cold, and famished. My head was swimming with exhaustion, and frost from my breath lay on the high collar which I had pulled up almost to my eyes. For some time before we reached it, we were able to see our convoy, standing out clearly, black against white. Its progress had indeed been small. The trucks had sunk in through the icy white crust over the tops of their wheels, and great slabs of snow clung to their tires and mudguards. Almost everyone had taken refuge inside the cabs. After chewing on their meager rations, they had wrapped themselves in everything they could find, and were trying to sleep, despite the bitter cold. A short distance away, the two fellows who'd been chosen for guard duty were stamping on their boots, hoping to warm their feet. Inside the cabs, through the frosted glass, I could see an occasional gleam from someone's cigarette or pipe. I climbed into my truck and felt in the darkness for my rucksack and messed in. When the tin was propped between my icy fingers, I wolfed down a few mouthfuls of some filthy mixture that tasted like frozen soya. It was so bad that I tipped most of it onto the snow and ate something else. Outside, I could hear somebody talking. I craned my neck to see who it was. A small fire had just been kindled in a hole in the snow, and was burning with a cheerful brilliance. I jumped down from the truck and hurried as fast as I could toward this source of light, heat, and joy. Three men were standing beside the fire, among them my Feldwebel of this afternoon. He was breaking pieces of wood across his knee. "I've had enough of this cold. I had pneumonia last winter, and if I get it again it's goodbye to me. Anyway, our trucks are visible for at least 2 miles, so we're not giving anything away by just lighting a few sticks."
"You're right," replied a fellow who must have been at least 45. "The Russians, partisans or not, are all snug in their beds.
I certainly would be glad to be home in my bed," said another, staring into the flames.
We were all practically in the fire, except for the big Feldwebel,
who was busily reducing a packing case to fragments. Suddenly someone shouted at us. "Hey, you over there." A figure was approaching us between the trucks. We could see the silver trim on his cap gleaming through the darkness.